Accession number 17545, Reel 3.
Mr. Granfield, Reel 3.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was saying I got this dried fruit, I think it was pears or peaches, something like this, dried stuff, put in my ammunition, and I sort of chewed that as I went along. Anyway, it just seemed endless, because you could only move really at night, but we did move a bit by day, because we got up into the hills off the main road, or tracker that it was, and eventually we come to the top of the escarpment, looking down at over Sparkyard, because when you get up the escarpment, the road ceased, or the track, there was nothing, just rock scree right down to the beach. There was only a little fishing village. Mind, this was dark, about 2-3 o'clock in the morning. And there was all these troops milling about. There was a bit of a plateau up the top there, you know, and then it just dropped away down towards the beach, which we didn't know at the time, of course, obviously. And I was on my own, and I thought, I wonder if there's any Marines around here. And of course, I went around and I said, is there any Marines about here? And all of this educated voice, more educated but my voice, said, oh, yeah, you know. So I went over, and there was this officer, I can remember him, because he had his, you know, the officer's jacket, a raincoat that he had on, you know, and it showed up in the light, it was like, and I said, naturally, sorry, sir. Oh, no, he said, that's all right. He said, we're all on the same boat out there. And I said to him, I don't know where my mates are, I said to him. And all around there, there was chaps up there wounded, different states of wounds, some legs, some arms, and some their heads and all this. And apparently they kept them there in a lager, you know, to try to get them. And then I said to him, do you know what's happening, sir? And he said, all I know, we said, we're going to get evacuated. Now, that was the first I'd heard of evacuation, you know, and this Australian major told me to get this place down at Sparkyard. And I said, I want you to do something for me. I said, what's that? He said, you go down over this track. He said, you'll find a house facing the beach, as he called it, or the sea, he said. He said, you go down there and ask for Colonel Sergeant. I could see the funny side of it at the time. You see a colonel and his name was Sergeant, like, you know. But apparently he was the CEO of the 1st Royal Marine Anti-Aircraft Regiment. And so anyway, I slid down this track, and it was all just scree and boulders and rubble, you know. And I went down the side of the house, because the house was facing the sea. And as I went down the side of it, somebody stuck a revolver in the middle of my back. I said, what do you want? And of course I went like this, and it was a sergeant in the Marines, it was. I said, I've got a message from Lieutenant Mears, I said, for Colonel Sergeant. I suppose he was just taking precautions, because, I mean, parachutists, they reckon lives all over the place, you know, all this racket. But anyway, I went down there, I can remember going down the side of it and coming back in the front, and of course, just being born after the First World War, when there was a lot of First World War books about from my grandfather's days, because incidentally he had the War Illustrated every week. He had one every week of the Great Wars, they call it in their days. And of course, when I was a kid growing up, I used to see all these pictures of old building the trenches and all this. And when I went there, I come and see it now. I can close my eyes. He had this rotten old table and a bottle with a candle in it, which sent me back to my youth, you know. I used to look at these Wall of Illustrated. So I slung him up and I told him, I said, Lieutenant Mears sent me down, want to know if we get any messages. And he said, well, if you got any news. Well, he said, all I can tell you, he said, we're trying to get in touch with Alexandria by radio. He said, for the ships to come in and pick us up. But, he said, you can tell him, he said, if they come in tonight or any other night, 3 o'clock is the deadline. And 3 o'clock it's going to be. No matter where, he said, doesn't matter, they've got to leave at 3 o'clock. So I went back and told him that this, you know. So anyway, the following night, when we looked out in the distance, you could see the, you know, the black outlines of warships or destroyers or whatever they were, destroyers and cruisers, I think, weren't they? And then we started trying to take these wounded down. They said, well, we'll take the wounded down first, and that was a job, because it was incredible, because it seemed to be endless and dark, you know, and you was a bit hungry, dispirited, and what you were, I mean, your morale was right down around in your boots, really. So we started taking some of these guys down to the beach and leaving them there, and, well, because the ships never came in, all they done was bring in whalers, or, you know, they didn't come right in, because it's only about, I don't know if you've ever been there, it's only about 160 yards, the whole length of the beach, and they got, when you found out after, about they got about 16,000 troops off there, it was amazing. And so we went down there. I skipped a bit, because on the... when we was coming back, when we started routing back, we come across the commandos that had been landed there, and they were forming a rear guard. Oh, I just remembered something else too. Well, after the paratroops landed, because I can go back, it doesn't matter. I forgot this. When they landed, we had this company, and then we heard that they'd landed tanks, light tanks, out there, was it? So we went out one night digging tank traps, and there was this bank. We had one section out in front of us digging, with loaded rifles, the other section digging, and the other section resting, and then they would alternate the three gossams, you know, because when we was out there, the Germans started firing at us, you see, but it was dark. And you could see the traces going over. I mean, didn't take this worry us, because, I mean, to hit anybody in the dark is just sheer luck. But that was to digress. And I can remember digging down this bank, and the idea was that the tanks came down, they would topple over. Now, whether they lit tanks or not, I don't know. But anyway, we go back now to Sfarkia. Sorry about that. And so we got down and we took these guys down, and then we shacked up in the caves down towards Comet Tades, a place called Comitades, and we was down there one day, and this road was going down, you know, coming down the escarpment, and I can always remember seeing ambulance, you know, military ambulance with all red marks on it, and Jerry came down and he just blew it to pieces. He just fell over into the road. I suppose it's still there to this day, some, but it must be, I think, because these are. The ravines over there are very, very steep and precipitous, you know. Once you go down over, you're at it.
That was a German aircraft.
Yeah. And we got down into these washrooms. So we went back then, and then eventually I got down onto the beach. Because, like, it's difficult, you see, because I was on my own. It wasn't as if I had my mates that I joined up with, and I said, well, come on now, Stan, what can us do, you know, daddy. And so I got down onto the beach one night, and we started unloading ammunition. And as I said, the beach was only about 150 yards long altogether, and it shelved, well, not steep, but, I mean, you had to get into water. I can remember Matlow, he came in on this board, I think it was a sort of a whaler, and he put this ammunition box on his shoulder, and I nearly disappeared, and I nearly disappeared in the water. But anyway, I got it up and took it back at the beach, and they sent it back to the people that was going to do a rear guard up further there. And then someone else came by me, and they said, I don't know who it was, whether it was a soldier, sailor, marine, or what, I don't know. He said, there are some tin milk here, and it was evaporated milk. It was a case of... So we out of me bin, sticks it in there, and had a drink. And then I'd seen this naval officer on the beach, because you could see because of his gold rings, you know. And I said to him this particular night, it was... The other thing, you see, dates didn't mean anything over there. It wasn't until we came off and I knew what day I'd come off. I think it was the 28th, 29th, I think it was. And...
This is May of
41. Oh, yes, it's May. And I said to this officer, I said, what have I got to do, sir? Can you... Oh, I said, I'm on my Jack Jones. I said, you know, they was taking the troops out to the ships. And I can always... What he said to me, he said, well... Get on that one, he said, because if you don't get on that one now, he said, you've had it for the night. So I waited out, and it was a a navy whaler it was, because it had sides on, you know. And all I can remember, somebody picking me up by the scruff of the neck and ordering me inboard, and I was wet up to about my knees, you know. And that was that. Next thing I knew, we pulled away. I don't know how, whether there was a motor on there, what, I've no idea. And at that stage, I didn't care very much. Anyway, we got up then, and the next thing we got, I got up a scramble. We was up against it. All I could see was this massive iron, you know, like a steel wall. And of course, it was the side of a ship, wasn't it? So I got up the nets, and I got up on deck. And there was a crowd of matters, and the first thing they gave us was a big mug of ship's cocoa, which they call Kai in the Navy. Dark brown, greasy be on top. God. It's the best drink I've ever had. I can taste it now. And it was hot. And they took me down on the mess deck, you see. And of course, as soon as they realised I was a Marine, you know, what they call bootnecks or Royal, whatever you call them, you know, they said, "Well, you got any bootneck here?" I said, "Oh, okay." I said, "Go on, just about at it, you know." And with that, out comes the grub, you know, eggs and bacon, oh, it was there. And out comes the fangs.
Which ship is this?
And, of course, I didn't know at the time, you see, so I said to him, then I said, "What am I on?" "Oh," he said, "you're on Destroyer." It's HMAS Napier, the Australian squadron it was. And the captain was Captain Arlott, same name as the old film star. He was in charge of that particular convoy, and it was HMAS Napier. But she was wrong to Australian. But that, I don't know how they worked it, but then I think in those days you still had, you know, English people on there. Anyway, they treated me right royal, you know. I mean, without no doubt about it, they did. And of course, at 3 o'clock, you're the anchor going up, and off we went, and we got out. That it was dark, you know. And as we got out into the med, in the daylight come, we had our usual visitors, and you know, the Germans. First of all, they had some high-level bombers up over, and because all the guns of the ships, because there was I forget. Well, I do know it was there because I got it upstairs somewhere, what ships was in the convoy at the time. And I've got it down here. And all the guns, you know, they had some high-level bombers, and of course with that, the Stukas came down, and because they were diving down, and of course all the guns was opening up. But they done a bit of damage, but I never knew what it was, because, I mean, I was just a passenger, but the ship stopped in the water. And after a bit off she went, and we got out of range of them then. And we got back into Alexandra sometime in the evening. Because the biggest thing I ever done was when I got on the ship, I took my boots off, didn't I? As I took my boots off, and of course my feet was where I'd been walking for these over these hills, and of course my heels were blistered and red raw, and it. And of course, when I got Alex, when I went, I couldn't put him back on, you see. I mean, the fact that it was wet as well. So when I got to Alex, and they pulled out alongside and put the gangway down to go onto the quayside, you know. And of course, I had my boots in my hand, you know, and I know somebody come towards me. I don't know whether it was a woman or Salvation Army or what they were, I've no idea. And he said, "You're a poor man, are you all right?" I said, "Look, I'm all right. There's worse people than that coming back here," I said. And because when I looked out across the in Alexandria Harbour, there were ships there. One of them, the Nubian, I think she was called, the 6-inch gun was the shape of a meat hook like that, where she'd been hit. And the sailors, or the matlows as we call them, they had two spikes there, and they were just swabbing on the decks, and the blood and the bones and all was coming off, because we heard after she'd been hit coming out from Heraklion on the way back. And I think it was the Perth or something. I went to one of the ships, they dropped me right down the funnel, they killed about 200 people on board. Anyway, that was true. So anyway, and because as we went down, there was this, I don't know, was it military police? I just can't remember. Right, Rank, name and number, EX-1951, Lance Corporal J. Granville, Royal Marines. Okay. Now we eventually went into the naval camp called HMS Sphinx, and we sort of got kitted out, you know, and after a while, I always remember the first size, I take size 7s, the first pair of boots I had, I think there's about 9s or 10s or something I could get on. And then eventually, we knew the evacuation had stopped, and then some of my mates, for want of words, started dribbling back in, you know. And then you suddenly thought, where's Doug? Where's so-and-so? Prisoners of war. Assuming that for the rest of their life they would all be together, but that didn't turn out to be. There was shelters around the other and everywhere. And out of our battery, I think we were the biggest battery over there, a battalion, 480. I don't think about 80 of us got back. Consequently, we were stuck in Egypt, shortage of arms and legs, no Marines to reinforce them. We had to wait for over 18 months, nearly 2 years before we got reinforced eventually, because the MNDBDO went on. Some went out to, they sent there for volunteers once for hazardous duties, as they called it. And they finished up on the Irrawaddy under a name called Force Viper. Lost about 80 men. Some went down to the Maldives to put up coastal defence guns because they thought the Jerry's or the Japanese might have some idea of taking it over. We had a lot of them down there, down the Maldives. So some went up the Irrawaddy. Some, we stayed in Egypt on aerodrome defence, for the want of a word, because they thought we were trained anti-parachuters. And eventually we got reinforced, you know. We went back to a few searchlights after a bit around Suez. This was towards, you know, 42-ish, you know. In the meantime, the 11th Battalion, which was part of the MNBDO-1, which was an infantry battalion, fully trained in England, Vickers Machine Gun Company and all this thing, we were over there with a rifle that held 5 rounds. They was back in Egypt. Because when I got back, my mate said to me, I said, Fritters, you have been over there, not me. I said, you had the weapons. And because he said to me, is this still all right to talk like this?
Yes.
He said to me, he found me out, you see, we got back to the canal zone. And he said to me, you're Jack, he said, it's been all in the papers, you know. He said, there's plenty of creep business. He said, it's been all on the wireless. He said, been all over the place. I mean, when we were all, never thought of anything of this. I mean, we'd never gotten mail off or anything like that, you see. We'd never wrote any letters. And, I mean, we didn't... It was only the aftermath of it, though, we realised what was going on. So he said to me, you want to get... he said, I've sent a caregram off to me mother, he said. And because his mother was a widower, you see, obviously. So I got up to Alexandria. No, this is true. This is, you can believe this or believe it not. I got up to Alexandria, and they went into the, I think it was the Marconi cable office. I can see it in a fairly big building, sandbags all the way outside the front of it, you know, for bomb blasts. And as I was going in around the corner of the sandbag, this officer came out this way in a dark blue navy uniform. And I sort of accidentally bumped into him. Of course, being, you know, trained. I said, sorry, sir. And he said, that's all right. And I realized, and I looked at him, he was Australian Air Force, which they wore a darker blue than us. And I said, sorry, sir. And because he said to me, and then he said, I'm just going to send a care to my parents. He said, you haven't come across them. He said, you haven't come from Crete. I said, yeah. I said, yeah. And I said, yes, sir, I have. Do you know what he said to me? Do you want to go home? I said to him, I'd like better. I said, why? He said, I'm a pilot of a Sunderland flying boat. He said, I'm going back to Plymouth tomorrow. I mean, these Australians, I've met them, you know, in other ranks of life, and they got a different approach to military life than what we have, you know. Easy going, I mean, I seen them once fall in with a crowd, you know. And they made you say right this minute. Half of them would turn right, half of them turn left, some go like that, and some would go like that, like, you know. Because, I mean, it's a famous story in Crete about the Australians, you know, when Freiburg said, or somebody said, what about the Australians? You got no discipline, no. But he said, if you call, if you say good morning to them, they'll reply quite nice to you. that was very good. Anyway, he said to me, do you want to go, man? I said, I said, no, better. And he said, I'm going back to Plymouth tomorrow. I can get you on board. He said, no problem at all. He's out in the bay there, he said. He said, but after that, he said, you're on your own. If we get shot down over going back, he said, that's your affair. But the trouble is, I booked in, and I've said to my friends since, you know, and I told him, I said, just imagine me going back there, raving in Plymouth. And he said, where have you come from? I said, Spark here. And they said, where's that? But that was true, that was. And anyway, I sent the cablegram off and said that. But of course, I heard after, not until I come home in 1944, and, well, not so many years ago, I got my younger sister to live out there, and I go and see her every Sunday, and I don't know, one day, and she was telling me that, because she said, the Admiralty sent us a cable, or telegram to say that, you would, you know, you were safe, and you got off, like, sort of, for the want of the word, which I didn't know for years and years after. Because, I mean, believe it or not, I mean, when I come home and I got demobbed, I mean, that was it. It was an episode of my life that, as I say, I've heard more about Crete since Crete Vet Association than, I mean, we go up there, I mean, we don't talk about Crete, we've exhausted that a long time ago, what we thought they could have done. Because, I mean, basically, we think it was our balls up from start to finish. You know, considering they knew this and they knew that. Do you want my honest opinion of that?
Please.
Well, I think, you see, Freiburg, he was Churchill's golden boy of the Gallipoli, wasn't him? Now, Major General Weston, that was in charge of us, he was senior to Freiburg, and he was the commander-in-chief in Crete for about 3 days. Well, they'd had about six or seven before that. They'd been over there since October, and they'd sent the Cretan division back to Greece when the Greece campaign was on, and they said, "Oh, we look after Crete, because if that Cretan division had been in Crete, the Germans would have never on their life have taken that, never, because they would have fought to the last man and the last stick." I mean, when the women used to come out in the villages there, which is another story, and have a go at them, which was a pity. And I think, you see, that knowing what I know since about it, he was an Englishman, brought up in New Zealand, and being out, he was a dentist, and then took command of the New Zealand division. I mean, the chap was in charge of the Australians down at Retimo and down in Heraklion. I mean, they were more adventurous. What he believed in, see, he was getting amongst them while they're dropping. Because if you're amongst them, they can't fire their early planes at you. But, oh, he was obsessed with the seaborne invasion. Freiburg. I mean, for instance, this is a fact. The 2nd 7th Battalion, Australian Battalion, was at Retimo, which is about 20, 30 miles away. The 1st Welsh Battalion, which was a trained infantry county battalion, as we would call it today, was around Harnia, and instead of using them to reinforce his New Zealand brigade, which would take, well, of course, I mean, when they say brigade, they was under strength, because a lot of them would come from Greece anyway. Instead of, I mean, to me, if you think of it, he would have moved them from Harnia up and let the 2nd 7th take over where we were, because we had infantry, we had a Greek regiment near us as well. And of course, what happened? They got lost on their way, they got attacked because they tried to come up in the daytime, they was about 10 hours late, and then they sent up the Welsh regiment. They got encircled and a lot of them was taken prisoner. I got one chap now comes to our meeting, he was in the Welsh regiment. They moved there back some time ago, and they put a plaque up on the hill towards Galatas, where they were. I mean, it's loaded with plaques out there and monuments. One up at Stirling, he's there to an artillery regiment and the aircraft regiment that most of them, and they'll Let's talk about it. It was in the SBS. I'm trying to give his name. Ian Bradett.
Oh, Jellicoe.
Ah, Jellicoe. He was Ian Bradett. Mine is very, very, very moving, it is.
And, but when you got back to Egypt, you were a long time on airfield, if I'm
right. Yeah, yeah.
About 2 years, but
yeah, near enough. Yeah.
Did you ever go into action again?
And then we went, well, come to this, because I'm interested in those stories. See, as I say, because we were 80, we were about 480 strong, our battery, because we were the bit, numerically, we were the strongest crowd over there. And I don't know, I mean, I just don't know how many it was, but I suppose there was 80 of us got back, that was it. And we just said we had to wait till reinforcements to come from England. And then we were on defence around Suez for a long time, on the canal, on the aerodromes. And like they said in the Marine History of the Royal Marines that James D. Ladd wrote, 1919 to 1945, the army uses as workhorses just to do what they want to do. Because although we were Marines, we were still a lot under army command, you know. We were in England even. Now they're altering the format, aren't they? The Marines now are going more underneath the Navy. I mean, their headquarters now is at Portsmouth under the Admiral of the Fleet and all this sort of thing. But anyway, that's what happened there. And then eventually we packed us up. And the Japanese was making rude noises, you know, gone through Burma and Singapore and all this. And of course they had their eyes on Ceylon, didn't they? Colombo. So we went out there then.
Doing airfield defence again?
Yeah, yeah. It was on, well, on defensive work there, yeah. It was there for, well, they did attack the place, but they never got anywhere. And we was there then, and then we were all split up into different units. I was moved to a different unit, and then they found this first Royal Marine Brigade to go to Burma or somewhere around there. Because I mean, this is what we knew this after, because we were part of the 33rd Indian Corps then, under Lieutenant General Stopford, and we got kitted up. Jungle stuff, you know, slow shots and all this other business. Trying to go from landing craft. Wondered what it was all about. I mean, after all, as far as I was concerned, I'm just a cog in the wheel, you know. We were there, trained to go on landing craft.
You were where?
In India then. We'd gone from Ceylon. We went from Ceylon to India by train. Took us, what, 6 nights and 7 days to get there. And we landed at a place called, well, I think it was called Galunchi, just outside Bombay. And we started doing this year training to go over this 33rd Indian Corps. And we were still there, some of the chaps, I don't know where the rest of them were. Or the M battalion, they were